Welcome to the Retzel Health Law Hotspot. Health Law Hotspot is a podcast for physicians and health professionals that covers the legal issues and trends that affect the healthcare industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Health Law Hotspot. I'm Erica Adler, shareholder at Retzel and Andrus and leader of the healthcare practice. Today, we have a great topic. We're going to be talking about some of the HR issues and cultural issues that arise in healthcare transactions. We have an amazing guest. Jennifer Fongervais is joining us today. Jennifer is the founder of Day One Ready, a consultancy that advises forward-thinking business leaders, owners, and C-suite executives on how to prepare for the human capital challenges of M&A. As a Fortune 500 C-suite survivor, as she puts it, of three multi-billion dollar acquisitions, Jennifer has been on all sides of the deal equation. She's seen countless growth strategies fail due to a workforce that couldn't pivot and adapt as quickly as leadership anticipated. Welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm blessed that you called it an exciting category and topic. Acquisitions, people tend to approach it with dread. So it was very nice intro.
Well, thank you. And I think this is really a great topic. And obviously today we're looking at it from the healthcare perspective. So how are these healthcare acquisitions and sales that are going on, these mergers, what is the human capital cost? And, you know, one of the things that got you and I started talking on this was that I very often feel like people jump into these transactions. They really don't think about what it's going to be like to work for the buyer after the deal takes place. And the buyer doesn't spend enough time kind of thinking about, you know, have we thought about these issues well enough before doing the deal? And I know you've seen some failures occur. So maybe just give us a little bit of insight on kind of what your experience has been and what you think of this topic.
Well, and it's interesting, Erica, and we talked about this a little when we were together. With 2020, the number of mergers and acquisitions happening in the healthcare space, it's the number one business segment right now that's going through M&A deals. And what I've seen, and I'm sure you've experienced it as well, is particularly with family practices, right? Doctors, dentists, veterinarians, the groups that I have worked with, it can be very hard when you've built your legacy around this business, and now you're deciding whether you align with another company, whether you are acquired by a private equity. And exactly as you said, you need to be smart as a seller about who it is you're getting in bed with and how that dynamic's going to play. Too often what I see is there isn't enough discussion around what's that desired future state, and do you both agree on what that desired future state is and how you're going to operate? And that can be a rude awakening post the deal when suddenly decisions that you made that you thought you could still make that now are no longer yours, how your employees are treated in terms of payout. There's a multitude of things. I don't want to bore you with the whole list, but it's just exactly as you said.
Right.
There are a number of aspects that need to be considered before you sign the deal. And this is not to say that M&A is bad. I am actually pro M&A, but I think there's too often that human capital piece that isn't discussed. And that's where you see a lot of the trouble occur.
Right. And I absolutely agree. And, you know, from the legal perspective, when I'm looking at these transaction documents, I am saying, you know, when I'm representing the seller, you know, what do you think it's going to look like? You know, what say do you want over the hiring and firing, your own schedule, how many hours a week you're really working, what you're doing, you know? So sometimes, like I was talking with a doctor today, and after being acquired, she's going to be required to do 32 clinical hours a week. And I said to her, do you do 32 clinical hours? Well, no, I spend time, you know, coordinating care, and I spend time doing records. I said, but now it's going to be 32 clinical hours a week. So really need to look at the nuances and how are those hours scheduled? How many patients an hour? You know, what services are you going to be allowed to provide or not provide? What are the hours of operation? Are they going to be looking for evening and weekend? So there's a lot of lifestyle elements.
Right.
And in my experience, it's the lifestyle things that really kind of turn things sour, if you don't talk and think about them ahead of time, those are really the things that people clash on. You know, what do you mean I have to work on the weekends? Or what do you mean now I have to see more patients an hour, right?
And to your point, I said, just because you didn't discuss it doesn't mean it's not going to change. That's why it's great that you're an advisor on that, because there are way too many assumptions that are made. And exactly as you pointed out, and that can be a rude awakening when suddenly you find out, oh, this isn't what I expected. It's why I do so much work building alignment with both sides. If there's a merger or one's acquiring another, so that they're equally aligned on what the desired future state is and how that's going to operate. And you know, once you've had those discussions, and I'm in the same boat you are, have the discussions early on. Make sure that you are crystal clear on expectations. It's an interesting reality in that a lot of my new clients have been entrepreneurs or business owners who want to understand how to work with private equity, because they recognize they've been running the business, but now the metrics for success are changing. And they recognize that maybe their operating style is going to have to change. And so that's been a new part of my consulting, is now that you're working with private equity, what does that look like?
What do you find some of the tensions are between the private equity and the business? And it doesn't have to be healthcare, just in general. I mean, I always find private equity is very focused on making a profit and being profitable. And it's a little bit more geared towards the financial aspects, whereas a lot of times business owners were more maybe on the human side or the customer side. Has that been your experience?
Well, I'm pleasantly surprised. I'm happy to see that more private equity are recognizing the human side, the personnel side, while they are transactionally driven, understandably, right? They're focused on getting the deal done. I've had more private equity start to come to me and have me advise, you know, speak to their CEOs who are about to go into a company. Because in the past, unfortunately, I think they've had that reputation for just, it's purely the financials. You got to hit these marks and that's it. The capital infusion is absolutely a big part of why you want to partner with private equity. Right. But what they're seeing is the benefit of equally being upfront about, here's the expectations, here's how we can help you, but here's what we expect in return. And having those conversations early on can make for a more fruitful partnership. So a lot of the advising I do when people, business owners talk to me about, how do I work with private equity? I will say you need to prepare not only yourself, but your leadership team or just the team around you. Maybe in the past, you had casual Monday morning meetings and you just kind of went through what was going to happen during the week. Private equity is going to give you that capital infusion, but it comes with expectations of where are you hitting your numbers? How are you hitting your numbers?
Right.
You need to be more buttoned up as a reality of that. And so it's a different dynamic. And private equity might think, well, this is just how we always do business. But it can be, as you've highlighted, right? It can be a sudden like, oh, that's not how I've run my meetings in the past. That's not how I've thought about my numbers in the past. Well, you need to be smart about that when you go into that partnership.
Right. And I think unfortunately some practices or companies that are acquired have been grown a little bit more organically and they don't have a lot of those formalities in place, and it can be a bit of a shock. So I think having a good team around them when they enter into those arrangements is important. We try and work with our clients, and you do that as well, just to let them know what to expect. And unfortunately, I still think, even though a lot of private equity and even, you know, hospitals are a little bit more used to dealing, obviously, with doctors, as are some of those, you know, big institutions. But, you know, right. Private equity, sometimes they say things that are really blunt and shocking to me. You know, I was relating to you that I had a doctor in a group who was about to leave on maternity leave and had already planned that she was going to switch to 4 days a week and had talked about it with her partners. And then, you know, but when she related this, they were just like, well, it's not in your contract. And she's like, well, this is what I want. And they were like, you know, their response was, every day you don't work, you lose us money. And so we're not letting you change anything about your contract. And, you know, those kinds of comments and a failure to really be sensitive to the people who are going to work for you sour the relationship. You know, you want somebody to stay with you long term. You don't want them to despise you. You want them to give you the best work. You want them to help you grow by reputation, you know, word of mouth or whatever it is, whatever kind of business it is. Like, that kind of attitude is really harmful.
And I, you know, it's interesting. There were a couple of comments when I was first thinking about opening my consultancy, because frankly, and Erica, I think we talked about this, that originally all I planned to do was write a book. I wanted to write a survivor's handbook, as you highlighted, survivor, because I'd gone through three multi-billion dollar acquisitions. And I thought these could have gone so much better had there been more transparency, had the people who were most affected by the deal been given a clear vision on here's what drove this deal, here are the opportunities with this deal, and here's how you can contribute. And because that people strategy, the people perspective hadn't been considered, is why time and again, at least in the deals that I experienced, they didn't achieve their valuation. And then when I interviewed 60 executives from all sides, right? CEOs, CFOs, HR leaders, middle market, each said consistently, I wish I'd paid more attention to the people part of the deal. I think that would have helped us be more successful. And exactly the point you just make, and it isn't just even private equity, but yes, I've seen they've abused this the most, is operating through fear is not a long-term strategy, right? Making people feel as though if I don't hit my numbers, then I won't get the support that I need. That people don't tend to do their best work. And that was a big part of what I saw in the, right, not only the deals I experienced, but when I interviewed, the valuations weren't realistic. And so suddenly you've got people who are having to hit numbers that are almost impossible too.
Right.
And that's really what drove me to write the book and to open up my consultancy, was to advise people to be smarter about that approach, right, both the executives as well as the people going through it.
Right. And I think it's definitely a learning experience. I mean, I'm not trying to knock private equity, because I think, you know, so many of my clients, we do so many deals with them. Some are smarter about it than others. Some are learning from experience just like you did. And I think it's going to take a while till they really start to see themselves as partners as opposed to acquirers. And I think that's really the different way of thinking about it. When you look at some of the transactions, some of the human elements that went wrong, what are some of the things that you think, or that people related to you? You mentioned the people, but what are some of the mistakes that were made?
So, and one of these I talked about in a Harvard Business Review article back in 2018, because it was a theme that came up while I was doing the research for the book. Everyone assumes there's an us versus them dynamic between our company and their company. But what is underestimate, but equally happens, there's two other dynamics that are at play. It's your executive leadership versus frontline leaders. And this is mid-market. Frankly, it can even happen in smaller companies where the belief is the executives got off great, right? They get the payout. They've known about this for a while, yet your employees, when they just find out about it, their typical reaction is they feel blindsided. They feel that suddenly they thought this was, you know, we were all in this together, and now suddenly it looks like you got off really well and now I've got twice as much work. And so there's an executive versus frontline leader dynamic that equally can undermine the success of the deal. And then the third dynamic that I've seen is who stays versus who goes. And what was fascinating to me in the research was the people who stay feel like the ones who got out get off better. And the ones who leave feel like the ones who stay got off better, right? Because the ones who are still in the company think, well, they got to leave. They're not having to deal with the chaos and the churn and the constantly changing strategies. While the people who left think, well, why didn't I get to keep my job? Well, I was actually higher than that person. How come they got to stay? And so that dynamic as well can equally be at play. And so the reason why I highlighted those dynamics in that HBR article is that's human nature. And you have to anticipate. I always say when people say, well, the deal didn't go as well because of unexpected people problems. And I say, they're not unexpected. You just have to plan for them, anticipate them. And it's why when I've been talking with private equity, who in the past would say, I love what you're doing. Your message is spot on, but we can't have you in the room too early because we don't want to mess it up. And I say, I'm not there to mess it up either, but you need to have some of these discussions sooner in the process to have clear line of sight on expectations for both sides. And so you can communicate to your frontline leadership the vision of the deal in advance, or excuse me, not in advance, but you can convey the vision right. In a way that your frontline leaders understand where you're going, why the deal happened, and then how they can contribute. And so it's those missed opportunities, I think, that really over time can undermine the success of the deal.
Right. And I think timing is so important. I mean, I know a lot of transactions we do, you know, the seller doesn't want to tell any of their employees until the very last minute, you know, in case it doesn't go through. And also for fear that they're going to leave.
Absolutely.
In healthcare transactions, if you don't keep or retain, you know, especially the clinical related personnel, then your purchase price goes down. Your potential earnout goes down. So if they're not on board, the deal that you think you have, you don't have, right?
Absolutely.
Each person plays such an important role, and they're so afraid. Sometimes they don't even tell them until the morning of the deal closing. And, it's scary until, you know, everybody, we get everyone kind of signed on.
And I agree. You cannot tell too far in advance for all of the reasons you said. Definitely not morning of, you know, with a lot of advisors who I've spoken to, it's that 2 to 3 week period in advance. But where I emphasize the need to focus is to be crystal clear on what that announcement is, what drove the deal, what are the opportunities, and to look at it from, you know, get into the shoes of the people who you are announcing this to. You've maybe lived for a while, or you've been thinking about it for a while. Then it took a while for the deal to happen, but it's certainly been information you've known for a while. Now you have to look at it from the standpoint of, I'm just finding out that my whole world has changed. And I don't know if I still have a job. I don't know if I still have the same boss. Are you going to still be in the company? All of those questions pop into my head, right? As the employee.
Right.
And so it shifts quickly from being, how do I help make the business successful, to how do I keep my job? How do I navigate this? And so I'm always advising executives, business owners, you need to be prepared for that. And it's human nature. So here's how we prepare, and here's how you craft a vision so that people understand not only where the company's going, but how they can contribute to it.
I think those are excellent points. And I know, you know, I speak with a lot, I often work with physicians and dentists and other healthcare providers who work for companies that are being sold. So they're not the owners, they're not the seller. And often they're being presented with, you know, a contract that's long-term that they have to sign. The terms are different than the ones from their prior contract that they negotiated. And it's kind of like a take it or leave it. Sometimes there's a nice bonus, but the question is, you know, is it worth it for me to stay? But, you know, on the other hand, they're put in a position where the deal is going to close and they don't have another job. So, you know, their initial contracts, it's super important to get those reviewed so that they have notice obligations and protections like that. But I think too often the buyer is very focused on the owner of the company.
Right.
They believe retaining the goodwill is key, and the owner is the one, you know, getting the money and making the best deal for themselves. In the healthcare context, that might be a context that might be a retiring dentist, doctor, or multiple, you know, owners like that. Whereas their associates who kind of were dreaming of, you know, one day becoming co-owners and you know, taking over the business, their dreams have been shattered. And so there's a lot of that kind of emotion as well. In the transactions that you do, I guess, have you seen reactions by, I don't want to call them underlings, but you know, the rank and file employees, you know, what kind do people generally come around to seeing the positive? Do they lose a lot of them because of fear of the unknown, or what kind of reactions do you get?
Unfortunately, it's more the latter, right? You lose them. And you said something up front that I just want to underscore, which is, you know, for the seller, the opportunity for you to really, this is your legacy, right? And if you want your people to be treated a certain way, you want certain things, whether it's hours or titles or bonus, whatever, your opportunity to do that is right at the beginning. And that's something that I've seen that's happened a lot, where there are assumptions made about what's going to happen and how it'll play out. And you need to be crystal clear. And that's why your role is so important, Erica, to advise and have people be smart about, well, what are your expectations, not just for you, but for the people who work with you, even if you're retiring. There are certain things that you can make sure are part of that deal, so that the people who helped you build your business, build your legacy, can still benefit from that. And that's, I think, the most heartbreaking part is for those business owners who retire and who have built it up and had the people help them build it. If it doesn't go well afterwards, you know, that great partnership and camaraderie can be lost. And that's the hard part. I unfortunately suspect you've probably seen that, Erica. And that's what I've seen as well. So I'm always advising, be smart in those early discussions to make sure everything you are expecting is written down and agreed to, because it's not necessarily just going to happen.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, nothing ever goes as planned, no matter what, but at least, you know, you can't just look out for yourself as the seller owner. You have to look out for those other people if they're important to you. I will say, sometimes people are just in it for themselves and they figure that people who work for them are going to want the job and want the money. On the other hand, I've seen seller owners who will do anything and fight any battle to make sure that they're protecting their people. And, you know, and then there's the ones that are kind of in the middle. So there's the full realm. And I guess, you know, you push as hard as you can. And on the other hand, there's the buyer, and the buyer's role in all that is really to understand that their contributions to a balanced deal for everyone ensures success of the business, long-term retention of employees. But I'm guessing you see this as well, that they don't have that vision. You know, I'm seeing, you know, a wide variety of buyers, and, you know, sometimes they have the vision, sometimes they don't.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I shared with you early on, you know, the private equity firms that I spoke to said, really interesting what you do, but, you know, can't have you in too early. What's been interesting, though, is they'll bring my book in. So they're starting to bring my book in and have executives read the book. So, because I talk about the stages of grief that a company can go through post deal. And it's not just me that went through this, but I've talked about it with every executive. And they said, yeah, we hadn't anticipated, you know, people talk about the change curve. I find that's a very academic way of describing the emotional roller coaster that you go through in merger and acquisition journey. And so I talk about the stages of grief and the personalities, how people change when fear is the operating emotion, when they go from being focused on the business to focused to preserving their job. And so what's been beneficial, now they're realizing, oh, well, the book's helpful, but maybe having you come in and talk afterwards can help people get, you know, give them line of sight on what to expect. I think it's slow, but I see it happening. I would love to see if you see the same. There's a recognition that throwing money at the problem won't necessarily solve the problem. I think in the past it was like, well, you know, I don't see this is going to be an issue, so we don't want to do anything to upset where we're going with the deal. And if it becomes an issue, we'll just throw money at it. Right. As you said, right? You could lose great talent, lose morale.
For some people, throwing money is a solution, but you're right. I mean, it's a short-term solution, really, right? So tell us the name of the book, just so we're all kind of on the same page. What is the book called, and where can people get it if they want to find out more?
So the book's called Now What? A Survivor's Guide for Thriving Through Mergers and Acquisitions. And I called it Now What? because I felt like, particularly in my very first acquisition experience, I'd have, you know, one of my reports coming into my office and going, you won't believe it, but the strategy's changed, or so-and-so left, or whatever. And I'd be like, really, now what? And so I, when I was trying to think of a book title, and my illustrator is the one who said, well, that would be a great name for a book. Now what? And it really, the intent of the book, the people who I wrote it for are those people who aren't in the room when the deal is made, but who are burdened with the execution. That's who I wrote it for. But what I have found is that executives, business owners, even private equity have equally found it valuable because it gives a clear line of sight on what to expect, a transparent view on what an organization goes through, the personalities, as well as then how to thrive, right? That's the focus of the book. I want M&A to be more successful. I want business owners, you know, the healthcare space in particular, given what it's going through, to be successful in making that deal good for both sides. And you can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target. I also just came out with an Audible. So if you don't like to read, but you like to listen,
I've
done the Audible version.
And we'll include a link when we kind of share this podcast as well, so everybody can see that. So now that you've written the book and you've kind of been out there, is there anything that you think you would change about the advice you gave, or anything that you're seeing a change in what's going on, and maybe, you know, the way people are handling M&A has been modified since you first went through your transactions?
So I would say, and it came through my own personal evolution, my own personal journey. When the very first sample chapter that I wrote for my book, it was like a vendetta. You know, I was literally, you know, getting out all of the demons for that had plagued me during my M&A experience. And I would say, particularly after the interviews that I had done, and now that I've been working in this space, mergers and acquisition can be a legitimate growth strategy. That 70-90% failure rate, I think, gives people a tendency to think, oh, I don't want to work with private equity. This will never be good. It can be. But the work that I do is to make sure you are eyes wide open, not just, you know, talking to an accountant and a lawyer or even a biz dev, but equally talking to a human capital advisor. I'm one of many. I tend to be the exotic bird because I survived three and now want to advise, but getting that advice up front is invaluable. Your merger or acquisition can be successful, but you need to be smart going in. And so I would say what has changed for me was really the perspective that M&A can be a viable path. And it's more just the responsibility is yours to get, to not only get paid well, if you're selling, but equally to think about what's the legacy I want to leave and how do I create that as I go into partnership, whether it's private equity or another company.
I think that's great advice. And, you know, obviously in healthcare, we spend a lot of our time doing M&A. It's been a tremendous year in 2021, just the number of transactions, you know, veterinary, dental, medical practices, just it's been, you know, I've been practicing almost 25 years. I've never seen this volume of deals. And some of them are hospitals, some are practices buying other practices. A lot of it is private equity. And you're right. I mean, it's an ever-changing you know, environment. And I anticipate we're going to continue to see, you know, more and more such transactions. And it's, you know, I haven't really seen any of those fail so far for the most part. So we're looking pretty good. Sometimes we undo them, but very rarely. So I expect we'll continue to see more. And this is all really great advice. For those of you who are thinking of selling, you know, pick up Jennifer's book and get an idea of some of the things you should be thinking of. And hopefully we've got some buyers out there who maybe could do a better job in, you know, the human capital part of those transactions and make it a much more pleasant experience both before and after the transaction for the people that are working for them, right? And that's really the goal.
Right. And really, Erica, just applause to you because I think the role that you play is so crucial for sellers to be smart. So it's been a pleasure to be on your show because we're very like-minded in what the opportunities are in this space.
Well, I appreciate you having you here. And I think this is great advice. Any parting words you want to share?
No, I really, it was that last point. I think I'm just focused on legacy. The pandemic has changed, I think in a good way, people's thought about what do I want to do with my life? To see that things can change so dramatically in ways none of us anticipated. And so I focus a lot on legacy. What's the mark you want to leave? And be smart how you think about it. And that's why I say M&A is viable rather than seeing some of these businesses that are in duress, you know, disappear. My hope is that those businesses can stay vibrant. And so, you know, I'd say think about your legacy and consider M&A, but be smart as you go into it.
Great advice. Well, thank you, Jennifer Fondrevet, for joining us today. And maybe we'll have you back in the future and find out what you're up to. And thank all of you for joining us on the Health Law Hotspot. And we'll see you here next time. You can find out more about us at ralaw.com and also view our other podcasts there as well. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Retzel Health Law Hotspot is made available by the firm and its attorneys for educational purposes and to provide general information, not to provide specific legal advice. Use of the Retzel Health Law Hotspot does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and the firm or any of its attorneys. The Retzel Health Law Hotspot should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice, and you should contact an attorney in your state about any legal needs or questions you may have.